If George Washington represented the heart of the American Republic, John Adams aspired to be its brains. And it should be said that few people had better reason for such an aspiration. Born in Quincy, Massachusetts in 1735, John Adams was a fifth-generation New Englander, son of a deacon and a town selectman, and of a daughter of the Boylston clan, which linked him to three generations of Boylston physicians and merchants. To say merely that he was strictly brought up would be an injustice to New England's pursed-lip sense of Puritan sobriety. My parents held every species of libertinage in such contempt and horror, and held up constantly to view such pictures of disgrace, of baseness, and of ruin, that my natural temperament was always overawed by my principles and sense of decorum. He was packed off to Harvard College in 1751, his father expecting that Harvard would make a clergyman of him. Instead, it made him a lawyer. He married his third cousin, Abigail Smith, in 1764, a union that lasted for 54 years and produced six children who formed what might be called the first family of the Republic. A son, John Quincy Adams, eventually served as president. A grandson served as American representative to Great Britain during the Civil War. And a great-grandson became one of the nation's most famous historians. Adams made his first mark politically during the Stamp Act frenzy in 1765. He then sat in both Continental Congresses and was a member of the committee appointed to draft the Declaration of Independence in 1776. He was not an eloquent speaker, nor did he have the massive, intimidating presence of George Washington. As an adult, Adams was 5'6", and the portrait in the National Portrait Gallery, painted by John Trumbull in the early 1790s, shows Adams as short and round-cheeked, looking somewhat like a junior librarian. But that would be to underestimate Adams' talents with the pen. His first political opus, a dissertation on the canon and feudal law, vividly denounced the Stamp Act officers as missionaries of ignorance, foppery, servility, and slavery. The 12 essays he published in the winter of 1775, under the pen name Nove Anglis, argued that the colonies ought instead to be thought of as a second part of the British Empire, independent of the Parliament in London and answerable directly to the King. Even if the Parliament of Great Britain had all the natural foundations of authority, wisdom, goodness, justice, power, in as great perfection as they ever existed in any body of men since Adam's fall, would not such an unlimited subjection of 3 millions of people to that parliament at 3,000 miles distance be real slavery? When Lexington and Concord cut short the Nove Anglis essays, Adams concluded that there is no good government but what is republican. If the 13 colonies were all possessed of such forms of government, and a confederation for the above purposes was agreed on in Congress and ratified by the assemblies, they would be unconquerable by all Europe. Yet there was an eccentricity in John Adams which put people off all too easily. He was blunt to the point of rudeness. I have never been used to disguise my sentiments of men whom I have been against in public life, he wrote. Candor is my characteristic. But it was a candor which was unredeemed with the slightest trace of wit or humor, and it was larded with an almost comical degree of self-regard. There are very few people in this world with whom I can bear to converse, he admitted to Abigail Adams. I am never happy in their company. He was sufficiently imposing as an intellectual that the Continental Congress dispatched him to France, along with Benjamin Franklin, to represent the new United States. Unlike Franklin, however, he made no attempt to accommodate himself to the free and easy mores of French life. Mr. Adams has given offense to the court here, Franklin reported, by some sentiments and expressions contained in several of his letters written for the Count de Vergennes. Vergennes, the French foreign minister, was less polite. Adams, he said, has an inflexibility, a pedantry, an arrogance, and a conceit which renders him incapable of dealing with political subjects. Franklin was exasperated by him. He means well for his country, is always an honest man, often a wise one, but sometimes, and in some things, absolutely out of his senses. Still, for all that John Adams was quite vain and ambitious, even the French conceded that he was a man of great talent, the best politician, the best negotiator, the best legislator of the century. Even Thomas Jefferson, who admitted that Adams was possessed of a degree of vanity and of a blindness to it, thought that Adams was as disinterested as the being which made him, profound in his views and so amicable that he predicted that James Madison would love him if ever you become acquainted with him. What Adams lacked in popularity, he made up in respect. And so, partly because Adams, like Jefferson, had been out of the country on diplomatic missions, had not participated in the Constitutional Convention, and so had not unduly antagonized anyone in America, he snagged 34 electoral votes in the first presidential election, coming in a distant second to Washington, and was thus duly installed as Washington's vice president. His two terms as vice president were politically uneventful, although he cast 29 tie-breaking votes in his role as presiding officer of the Senate, a record that still stands. But personally, he continued to blunder from one irritation to another. He had no sooner occupied his vice presidential chair before he began lecturing the Senate on the need to adopt more formal titles for the president and for himself. What will the common people of foreign countries, what will the soldiers and sailors say, he argued, George Washington, President of the United States, they will despise him to all eternity. The Senate ignored him. But the press did not, accusing Adams of being an avowed monarchist. Then, in April of 1790, Adams began publishing a series of essays, Discourses on Davila, Davila being Enrico Caterino Davila, the 17th century historian of France's religious civil wars. In these essays, he predicted that the French Revolution would end up in much the same catastrophic way that those religious wars had ended up. Did the French revolutionaries preach equality? They should know, Adams wrote, that a perfect equality shall never long exist between any two mortals. The controversy between the rich and the poor, distinctions which no art or policy, no degree of virtue or philosophy can ever wholly destroy, will continue. Were the revolutionaries enemies of monarchy? They would soon find themselves entangled in what is more to be dreaded, simple despotism. Only an independent executive authority can be a mediator or an arbitrator between them. This, of course, astounded James Madison. John Adams has made himself obnoxious to many, Madison wrote, by the political principles avowed in his book. Jefferson thought the title controversy was the most superlatively ridiculous thing I ever heard of. Even Alexander Hamilton was not without apprehensions that Adams would end up embarrassing the Federalists and give additional weight to the opposition to the government. And Adams glumly suspected that Hamilton and Jay have insidiously intrigued to give Thomas Pinckney a sly slide over my head. But Adams had the blessing of Washington, and he was certainly more acceptable for the presidency in 1796 to Hamilton and other suspicious Federalists than the alternative, which was Thomas Jefferson. And Adams was singularly fortunate in the appalled reaction of the French Republic to the Jay Treaty, in which the French inadvertently made President John Adams, temporarily, the most popular man in America. By 1796, the reign of terror in France had collapsed into the reaction of Thermidor, and the French Republic was now ruled by a five-man directory, which was still embroiled in war with Austria, Prussia, Spain, and Great Britain. The directory regarded the Jay Treaty as a stab in the back of a fellow republic, and they responded by declaring their own open season on American shipping, promising in a decree of July 2, 1796, that they would treat neutral vessels either as to confiscation, as to searches, or capture in the same manner as they shall suffer the English to treat them, which they did. The French had already been poaching American merchant vessels as early as 1793. Over the next several years, the captures would soar to over 400. During the controversy over the British orders in council, Congress had authorized the construction of 6 large frigates for the United States Navy, only to suspend construction once the Jay Treaty was signed. Now, in March 1797, Congress lurched ahead and authorized the completion of the first 3 of the frigates, United States, Constellation, and Constitution. And on March 25th, Adams called for a special session of Congress to consider what other measures he should take. "My entrance into office is marked by a misunderstanding with France," he wrote to his son, John Quincy Adams, "which I shall endeavor to reconcile, provided that no violation of faith, no stain upon honor, is exacted." In pursuit of conciliation with the French, Adams nominated a 3-man commission, 2 veterans of the Constitutional Convention, old Charles Cotesworth Pinckney of South Carolina and Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts, plus a rising Virginia lawyer and Federalist, John Marshall. Together, they were to conduct a negotiation with the French Republic for a removal of prejudices, a correction of errors, a dissipation of umbrages, an accommodation of all differences, and a restoration of harmony and affection. But from the beginning, nothing went well for this mission. The Directory, with studied rudeness, kept the commissioners cooling their heels for weeks before granting them an interview with the Directory's sleazy foreign minister, the turncoat aristocrat, Charles-Maurice de Talleyrand-Périgord. Talleyrand, curiously, was not necessarily prepared to demand hard bargains of the Americans. Talleyrand never disputed the right of the United States to make even a shameful commercial treaty with Great Britain, provided it does not violate their stipulations to us. But Talleyrand had been receiving reports from the French consul in New York that France needed be in no hurry to sign an agreement of its own with the United States. "Mr. Adams," the French consul had been told, "is vain, suspicious, and stubborn, but his presidency will only last 5 years. He is only president by 3 votes, and the system of the United States will change with him." If the commissioners continued to press for an agreement, then Talleyrand concluded that they ought to be willing to pay for it. An immediate gratification of $240,000 to Talleyrand himself, and a subsidy of $10 million to the Directory in the form of a loan. The commissioners were dumbfounded. So Talleyrand's intermediaries made it clear. It is money. It is expected you will offer money. Pinckney erupted. It is no, not a sixpence. The diplomatic back and forthing dragged on into the spring of 1798, when finally Marshall and Pinckney gave up and broke off the negotiations. Gerry alone would remain in Paris to keep an American ear to the ground. In Philadelphia, President Adams received his first dispatches from Pinckney, Marshall, and Gerry on the evening of March 4, 1798. And the next day, he sent a notice to Congress that they had been received and were being decoded from their diplomatic cipher. Despite mounting public demands for their publication, Adams wanted to be sure that the commissioners were safely away from Paris before finally, on April 3rd, sending the dispatches to Congress. Even then, Adams declined to reveal the names of the French officials involved. He substituted for their names the letters X, Y, and Z. But even so, the impact was staggering. The Jacobins in Senate and House were struck dumb, wrote Abigail Adams, and opened not their mouths. 3 days later, the texts were released to the newspapers, who reacted in anti-French fury. To be lukewarm after reading the horrid scenes is to be criminal, screamed the New York Gazette. And the man who does not warmly reprobate the conduct of the French must have a soul black enough to be fit for treasons, stratagems, and spoils. Pinckney's angry outburst of refusal became millions for defense, but not 1 cent for tribute. Adams became the hero of the hour, and France, the mortal enemy. Robert Treat Paine composed a song celebrating Adams and liberty. Let fame to the world sound America's voice. No intrigues can her sons from their government sever. Her pride is her Adams. Her laws are his choice, and shall flourish till liberty slumbers forever. When Adams attended a play in Philadelphia, nothing could equal the noise and uproar. The President's March was played and called for over and over again. It was sung and danced to, wrote Henrietta Liston, the wife of the British minister to the United States. Frigates are fitting out, men and money are voted, and every man speaking with a degree of violence at which I often stare with astonishment. No actual declaration of war was issued, but naval combat, a quasi-war, broke out wherever French and American warships crossed paths. Nearly 80 French vessels were gobbled up by American ships. And in February 1799, the frigate Constellation, under the command of Commodore Thomas Truxtun, fought and captured the French frigate Insurgente and beat another, the Vengeance, into a helpless hulk. When John Marshall arrived in Philadelphia on June 18th, he was greeted with parades and banquets as a hero. Such a shock on the Republican mind, admitted Thomas Jefferson, as has never been seen since our independence. Everywhere, Jeffersonian Republicans hid their heads, while Federalism flourished as patriotism. And then, with an ineptitude bordering on genius, John Adams proceeded, through two catastrophic blunders, to bobble away all the political advantages he had acquired. The first blunder was the passage of a series of acts fueled by the public panic, which were to eliminate the possibility that the French, on the pattern of Citizen Genet, would use French sympathizers in America to undermine the administration. These acts, known collectively as the Alien and Sedition Acts, were really four separate bills designed, As one of their sponsors, Senator James Lloyd of Maryland wrote to George Washington, "to enable us to lay our hands on traitors." The first of the Alien and Sedition Acts, the Naturalization Act, virtually tripled the length of time an immigrant had to reside in the United States to obtain citizenship. The second and third, the Act Concerning Aliens and the Act Respecting Alien Enemies, permitted the arrest and deportation of any immigrants suspected of treasonable or secret leanings, while the fourth, the Sedition Act, imposed fines and imprisonment for writing, printing, uttering, or publishing any false, scandalous, and malicious writings against the government of the United States, or either house of the Congress of the United States, or the President of the United States, with intent to defame the said government, or to bring them into contempt or disrepute. But the enforcement of these laws backfired. Its principal victims turned out to be not French secret agents, but Americans, who actually did nothing more than disagree a little too vocally with the Federalists. Matthew Lyon was arrested under the terms of the Sedition Act when a letter he published in the Vermont Journal complained of unbounded thirst for ridiculous pomp, foolish adulations, and selfish avarice on the part of the executive. Jefferson's favorite editor, the Irish-born William Duane, was indicted for seditious libel in Philadelphia. The indictment was overturned, only to be reinstated in July 1799, and yet again by a Senate committee. Jedediah Peck was a Federalist Justice of the Peace from Otsego, New York, who opposed the acts and, as a result, likewise found himself indicted for seditious libel. These were not the enemies Americans thought they were being called to guard against. And when Jedediah Peck was transported in chains for trial to Albany, the route turned into a martyr's progress. 100 missionaries in the cause of democracy stationed between New York and Cooperstown could not have done so much for the Republican cause as this journey of Judge Peck as a prisoner from Otsego to the capital of the state. It was nothing less than the public exhibition of a suffering martyr for the freedom of speech and the press, and the right of petitioning, to the view of the citizens of the various places through which the marshal traveled with his prisoner. Jefferson and Madison, who denounced the Alien Bill as a most detestable thing, which will drive these states in revolution and blood, and furnish new pretexts for those who wish it to be believed that that man cannot be governed but with a rod of iron, capitalized on this blunder by drafting two sets of anti-administration resolutions for the legislatures of Virginia and the new state of Kentucky to adopt in defiance of the acts. The liberty of conscience and of the press is an express and solemn declaration and cannot be canceled, abridged, restrained, or modified by the government of the United States. Consequently, declared Madison, the Sedition Act ought to arouse universal alarm since it is leveled against that right of freely examining public characters and measures and of free communication among the people thereon, which has ever been justly deemed the only effectual guardian of every other right. Let these acts stand, warned the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions, and it might be necessary for the individual states of the Union to declare these acts void and of no force. And Madison hinted even more darkly that the ultimate remedy might have to be secession of states from the Federal Union, since Virginians were determined to sever ourselves from that union we so much value rather than give up the rights to self-government which we have reserved. Adams might have been able to withstand the wave of revulsion which followed the Alien and Sedition Acts if The quasi-war with France had finally climaxed, as almost everyone expected it would, in a full-scale war with France, and carried everything with it on a wave of patriotism. But in August 1798, the Royal Navy, under the direction of Admiral Horatio Nelson, destroyed the core of the French Republican Navy at the Battle of Aboukir Bay, and thus removed much of the Directory's actual means for disturbing American shipping. The Directory itself was on shaky political ground, and in November 1799, its most successful general, Napoleon Bonaparte, would overturn it in a coup d'état and install himself as de facto ruler of France. Desperate to shore up their political position at home, the Directory now struggled to convince Americans that they are at present sincerely desirous of restoring harmony between this country and the United States on terms honorable and advantageous to both parties. This gave Adams the opportunity to reproduce for his administration the kind of diplomatic success Washington had achieved in the Jay Treaty. And on February 18, 1799, he announced that, always disposed and ready to embrace every plausible appearance of probability of preserving or restoring tranquility, he was appointing William Vans Murray, the current U.S. minister to the Dutch, to be Minister Plenipotentiary of the United States to the French Republic to discuss and conclude all controversies between the two republics by a new treaty. Now it was the turn of Federalist jaws to hang agape. Adams' Secretary of State, Timothy Pickering, saw that every real patriot who has steadily and supported Adams was thunderstruck. Weary of the abuse and misunderstanding, the thin-skinned Adams began to spend increasing amounts of time away from Philadelphia, at home in Massachusetts. By the time William Vans Murray and his negotiating team finally had a treaty ready for signing, Napoleon Bonaparte was in charge, and the French refused to offer compensation for losses suffered by American merchant ships. Murray signed it anyway on September 30th, 1800, but it did nothing to promote Adams' political standing. To the contrary, as one Boston merchant remarked to Timothy Pickering, the Jacobin influence is rising and has been ever since the mission to France was determined on. If a treaty be made with France, their ascendancy will be sure. Adams' Secretary of War, James McHenry, resigned. 5 days later, Adams demanded that Pickering resign as well. And when Pickering refused, Adams dismissed him with a curt note. Adams still had enough control over the Federalist caucuses to control their endorsement for re-election, but not in the country at large. Thomas Jefferson, in his second bid for the presidency, garnered 73 electoral votes, along with Aaron Burr, who would become his vice president. Adams won only 65. He was just in time to oversee the movement of the national capital to the new Washington City in the District of Columbia in November 1800, and take up residence in the far-from-completed executive mansion. But it was a moment of acute loneliness for John Adams, who had squandered both the goodwill of his friends and the enmity of his critics. To Mr. Jefferson's administration, I wish prosperity and felicity, he wrote. But the commencement of it is too strongly infected with the spirit of party to give much encouragement to men who are merely national. He could not bear to witness Jefferson's inauguration on March 4, 1801, and left the city he had so briefly occupied just before daybreak.